Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Sly Stone is still standing. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Yes, he's back. After being mysteriously silent for the last 20-plus years, the reclusive Sly Stone has granted his first interview since the 1980s to Vanity Fair. In the magazine's August issue, the flamboyant frontman of 60s soul and funk band Sly and the Family Stone talks about his music, his disappearance from public view, and his long-awaited return. David Camp wrote that Vanity Fair article, and he joins us here today. David, welcome back.
Nice to see you, John.
So your interview with Sly Stone seems like it's part of a renaissance of this man. Back in the public view, there's a comeback plan. Saturday night, he performed in San Jose. There are European dates that are in the works that he's ostensibly going to show up for. What do you think is bringing him back at this point?
It's an excellent question, and I don't think even he has a real answer. I think that he was just out to sea, and for a long time he was perceived, or there was innuendo, that he was in a vegetal state, that maybe he'd done so many drugs or he was just so damaged that this was never possible. And I think the main engine for all this is his youngest sister, Vieta, who goes by the nickname Vet. She sort of coaxed him out of it. She's a very loving, level-headed person, as level-headed as he is eccentric. And she just...
That's pretty level-headed.
That's pretty darn level-headed. And she just decided, I'm going to make an effort to see if I can get my brother to have this happy coda to his life.
So he's talking about recording a new album. Do you think that'll ever see the light of day?
Well, I would say that this Vanity Fair story is essentially the end of the beginning of this return, you know, meaning... Can you grasp that,
right,
John?
No, you're going to have to parse that for me, I'm afraid.
Have another cup of coffee, John. meaning it's still in the very tentative, delicate phase of a comeback. You know, we've seen in recent years other so-called recluses like Brian Wilson and Rocky Erickson, guys who were like music gods in the 60s, and again, presumed to be fried beyond rehabilitation. And now they're both doing very well as live touring acts. But people forget how shaky and how extended those comeback periods were. And with Sly, I think we're just seeing the beginning of this process. And that's what I'm saying. The Vanity Fair story represents the beginning of this process.
There is a link on our website to David Camp's article in Vanity Fair about Sly Stone, the flamboyant frontman of Sly and the Family Stone. This is a man who held thousands, tens of thousands of people in thrall at Woodstock, you know, almost like a preacher, you know, with his crowd. What's he like now?
Well, now, I don't know if everyone out there saw his bizarre appearance at the Grammys last year, but you can see he's aged. He no longer looks like that spectacularly handsome and flamboyant and blaxploitation fabulous man in a riveted leather jumpsuit who was doing karate kicks on the cover of the album Fresh. He's stooped. He has a bent neck. But all that said, he still has a kind of impish, mischievous, almost Groucho Marx-like spirit to him. When I was with him, he had a sort of, you know, he didn't have the cigar in his hand, but he had a kind of glimmer to his smile that's almost like he's been in on the joke of his disappearance.
Well, you mentioned the 2006 Grammy Awards where he was sporting a blonde mohawk, and MTV News reported the Grammy performance was a halting, confused affair and a complete disservice to his music. Whether you agree or not, it was at least the return after many years of Sly Stone, and this is a little bit of what it sounded like.
Hey, Sly! Let's do it like we used to do it! Come on!
Yeah!
from the 2006 Grammy Awards. That is Sly Stone. Sly and the Family Stone, almost the entire original lineup back together. That's important to a rock snob like you, David Camp.
I'm afraid it is. But that said, it was an affront to anyone with a true sense of rock snobbery because, first of all, you could barely hear Sly and all that. There were a lot of guest artists. The guy introducing him was Steven Tyler of Aerosmith. And even though they had assembled 6/7 of the original Sly and the Family Stone, which to a real music aficionado is a big deal, they actually buried those older musicians in the back and kept them off camera and instead, you know, focused on the sort of B-list stars they'd gotten to do the medley. And part of the reasoning behind that was this persistent bugaboo with Sly Stone is he's unreliable. Will he show up? Will he come through? So that was the Grammy producers' way of hedging their bets.
Hedging their bets, right. My guest is David Camp. He's contributing editor at Vanity Fair. He's been here before as one of the authors of the Rock Snobs Dictionary and one of the authors of the Film Snobs Dictionary. And his new book is called The United States of Arugula, How We Became a Gourmet Nation. So, I mean, in terms of our cultural landscape here, David, you've got it all covered. Why this obsession for so many years with this one guy, with Sly Stone?
Well, first of all, Sly now lives in Napa Valley, which is perhaps the food snobbiest place in the United States. So I mean, he even has grape arbors on his property, but he said, I don't do grapes. first of all, who among us doesn't, at the end of the day, have eclectic tastes? Who among us doesn't like food and music and film and sports? I mean, mm-hmm. But Sly in particular, I've always loved his music. I was born in 66, and Sly and the Family Stone put out its first album, A Whole New Thing, in 1967. So some of my earliest sentient moments are of the radio playing and hearing these wonderful songs like Stand and Everyday People, You Can Make It If You Try, I Want to Take You Higher. And I always loved this man's music. And then as time went on, and he disappeared, and there were all these dark stories of what had happened to him, his disappearance became in and of itself a heck of a story. So for two reasons, my genuine love of his work and my curiosity about what had happened to him, I pursued him on and off for about a dozen years.
Wow. And eventually got to him finally. He was worth the pursuit, I guess, you know, from a personal point of view because of piqued your curiosity or whatever, but from a musical point of view, let's talk a little bit about what Sly and the Family Stone meant at a time when, you know, seeing multiracial, you know, band, women and men together was still somewhat unusual.
Yeah, he very consciously put together this band that was four men, two women, five black people, two white people. And they were genre hoppers. You know, their music was kind of even that little snippet we heard of that, you know, fiasco Grammys performance. You can still hear how there's elements of soul and blues and rock and psychedelia. And he blended it all together in a way that didn't seem unwieldy or slammed together. And so he had that phase. And then he had a secondary phase in the early 70s where he basically invented funk as we know it.
Well, and that kind of slap bass sound.
Yeah, he had a bassist named Larry Graham, who was an excellent bassist, and Sly played some bass parts himself on certain songs. But yeah, so he, without him, I don't know if George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic would have sounded the same, or Earth, Wind & Fire, the Ohio Players, all bands of that 70s funk genre.
Let's hear a little bit from one of his classic top hits. Thank you for letting me be myself again, Sly and the Family Stone. Thank you. Sly and the Family Stone. We're talking about Sly Stone's long-awaited comeback with David Camp, who has written an article on Sly Stone after finally snagging the first interview with the man in decades. He was a very public figure for most of the late 60s, early 70s. Woodstock might have been the pinnacle of his career.
But the pinnacle of his being a public figure was when he chose to get married on stage at Madison Square Garden in 1974 with, Don Cornelius of Soul Train presiding.
Now, should people have looked at that point and said, you know what, this guy's on the way down?
Yes, they should have, because by then he was already artistically kind of a spent force for that period anyway, meaning, Small Talk, the album that came out that year, it's a good album, but it's way below the quality of the previous albums. And that was sort of the beginning of the end artistically for him.
So what happened? I mean, how did he slide from, this amazing figure, who changed the course of music and it basically invented that funk sound, to a guy who disappeared, who was rumored to be completely fried, who apparently was surrounded by, gun-toting entourages well before gangster rap was ever invented?
Well, I think it's a combination of two things. One is just that classic and almost cliched story of the rock star getting too big for his britches, getting hooked on drugs. He's a serious cocaine addict and is a recovering one now. So there was that aspect. And the other aspect might just be that he, like Brian Wilson, I think might have some mental problems. And again, he seems to be in a much better place now. Mm-hmm. But, that's why it's not always a joke. I think people love to say, oh, how fried he is, what a crazy figure he is. But there's something kind of sad and poignant about his efforts to come back now, too.
And it's funny, at 3:00 on Fresh Air today, the discussion is about drug abuse and, how drugs affect the chemicals, the chemistry of the brain, and how there can sometimes be a pathology at work. Mm-hmm. And it's not always, just a failure of will.
Or hubris.
So we're speaking with David Camp from Vanity Fair. His article, his interview with Sly Stone, is in the August issue. There's a link on the Soundcheck page of our website. Despite these problems, and they were many, and they were very much in evidence through the 70s, he did manage to hold it together, here and there, to release albums like, even by 1971, there's a riot going on. There was already some stuff happening then, apparently.
Oh, well, I thought you were going to talk about the later 70s and early 80s, and he put out albums, maybe every couple of years, right up until 1982. But it really ended in the early 70s as far as he was already well into drugs by the time There's a Riot Going On came out in 71 and then Fresh came out in 73. But those are still good albums.
Right.
In fact, the drugs might have even helped make them good albums.
But you kids stay in school now.
Yes.
Love and Hate, H-A-I-G-H-T, a reference to Haight-Ashbury. The
yes.
song Love and Hate
mm-hmm.
seems like this is 1971. We're not so far removed from the Summer of Love and Haight-Ashbury and all that kind of stuff. Already, there's this kind of bitter, I was going to say bittersweet. I think I'll just leave it at bitter.
Mm.
Look at what flower power and hippiedom and all that stuff meant.
And a spooky vocal treatment. I mean, there was something very disturbing about that record, as good as it is. And a lot of people, I think Rolling Stone has ranked it in the top 20 all-time albums. There's a Riot Going On. And that song, Love and Hate, is the opening song. And the first line of the opening song is, "Feel so good inside myself, don't want to move." And a lot of people interpreted that as Sly saying, "I'm retreating from being a leader and a uniter of races and genders and a 60s flower child. I'm just going to feel so good inside myself and sprawl out on the shag carpet and do some lines."
Right.
And I asked him about this because this album has been so picked over and decrypted by some big minds like Timothy White and Greil Marcus and just, your everyday rock snob like you and me, John. And and he said, it was where I was at the time. I don't know if I meant it as a bold statement. He says, people are welcome to think that. And I was like, come on, Sly, this is you. And I think he probably surprised even himself with how it came out.
Maybe he doesn't quite remember the whole process.
There's that too. Although I want to say, because a lot of people have been calling him fried, And, you know, now that I've spent time with him, I'm kind of rooting for him a bit. And he's not fried. You can have a linear conversation, and he's actually very clever. And I think some of it is gamesmanship, where he's trying to be mysterious. Perhaps there's an element of him, yeah, where he has done some serious damage to his brain.
But there's still a showman at work, is
Absolutely,
what you're saying.
Yes.
Let's hear a little bit from the song Love and Hate by Sly and the Family Stone. Love and Hate from the album There's a Riot Going On, 1971 album by Sly and the Family Stone. The big hit, David Camp, from this record was the song Family Affair, which also has that kind of muddied, muffled vocal delivery.
Yeah, talk about spooky.
Yeah.
As a child, I remember being actively scared by that song, by his vocal delivery, because it was so slurred. And in the article in Vanity Fair, I say it sounds like a heat-warped 45 being played at 33 RPM. But it was also compelling.
An illusion lost on a lot of your younger readers, I'm afraid.
Yes.
what is this, 45, 33?
Right.
It's MP3. It's just a 3. What's
it's like when your horseless carriage... Oh, never mind.
Now, whatever else he may have been, and as you say, he may still have a bit of the old showman in him, he was not a smart businessman, and made a dreadful mistake, as it turns out, in the 1980s by selling his publishing rights to Michael Jackson.
Yes, whose My Jack Music owns his rights. I don't know fully what the deal is with him, with Sly Stone financially. He lives in a nice enough place that he does indeed rent rather than own. There must be some stream of revenue coming in that's keeping him afloat, but he was not savvy about holding on to the publishing rights, which, given how often we hear his music on the radio, in commercials, in movies, you know, Thank You for Letting Me Be Myself Again is in Shrek 3, for example, right now, you know, out in theaters now. He could be a multi-millionaire, you know, in the hundreds of millions.
But you get the sense that, I don't know, is this comeback about money?
I don't think it is. I mean, I don't think it would hurt to make the money. I think the comeback is an attempt by him and by his sister to have, as I said, a happy coda to his life. Because, you know, he could have just stayed a recluse and just had it peter out. And, you know, it is kind of taking a chance. You know, some people are in love with the romance of Flame Out. And what he's going to do is he could potentially damage that romance by staging a comeback that doesn't quite come off. Again, I'm rooting for him, but I don't think it's about money. I think it's more about, you know, trying to make his life worth living again.
Well, I think I'm rooting for him too. David Camp, thanks very much for joining us once again on Soundcheck today.
Thank you for letting me be myself again.
David Camp's article is in the August edition of Vanity Fair. There's a link on the Soundcheck page of our website. This is Soundcheck. Everyday people.